Welcome back to the Deep Dive. If you're here, you know the drill. We give you the shortcut to knowledge, not just random facts, but the context, the connections, the stuff that makes the whole story make sense.
Right. And today, we're diving into, well, quite a story. 4 decades packed with stand-up comedy, massive celebrity, intense conflict, and ending, remarkably, with a quest for citizenship abroad.
Our subject is Rosie O'Donnell, born Roseanne O'Donnell, 1962. And when you look at her life, it's really a study in contrasts, isn't it?
Absolutely. You've got huge mainstream success. We're talking daytime Emmys, major Hollywood films, running headlong into these periods of just incredibly intense public controversy, often controversy she seemed to actively court, you could say.
It really is this massive amount of information, this real duality. So our mission today for you listening is to try and navigate all that. We want to distill the core achievements.
Yeah, the big moments.
The major pivots, both personal and political, and maybe understand some of that foundational stuff, the early life that really shaped her public image.
It's about clarity, context, you know, understanding how someone goes from being universally loved as the Queen of Nice to this hyper-political figure who just recently actually left the United States.
Okay, so sources. We've got a pretty comprehensive stack here. Covers everything from her early stand-up days, the big talk show era, let's call them turbulent years on The View.
Turbulent is one word for it, yeah.
And of course, this very recent, very public move to Ireland in 2025.
And to really understand the fire, you kind of have to look at the fuel, right? So that means going right back to the beginning, her earliest days.
Okay, let's unpack that foundation. Born, raised, Commack, New York.
Yeah.
Roman Catholic family, Irish-American roots.
Deep Irish-American roots. Her father, Edward Joseph O'Donnell, was actually an immigrant himself, came over from County Donegal.
And that detail about County Donegal becomes, well, surprisingly relevant much later on, as we'll see.
But that family life, it wasn't idyllic. Our sources are pretty clear. It was marked by significant tragedy and also what's described as generational abuse.
Yeah, the first major blow was her mother, Roseanne Teresa. She died from breast cancer. Rosie was just about to turn 11, March 1973.
Losing your mom that young, that's obviously devastating. But the sources indicate the trauma ran deeper than that loss.
They mention a really staggering history of family trauma. The phrase used is generational abuse and alcoholism.
Mm-hmm.
And they explicitly state that Rosie and her siblings were sexually abused by their father.
Yeah. And knowing that, I mean, it casts a different light on pretty much everything that follows, doesn't it?
It really does. It provides this psychological engine, maybe, the kind you often see in performers, people who need that external validation.
Exactly. And look at the contrast in her adolescence. This private horror happening at home, but publicly. She was thriving socially.
It's wild. Voted homecoming queen, prom queen, senior class president, and the key one, class clown.
Class clown. That feels significant, right? It suggests comedy wasn't just fun for her. It was maybe a survival tool. It's kind of social armor. Yeah. Being the funny one, doing imitations like Gilda Radner's Rosanna Dana character, apparently it's a way to control the room, deflect pain, get people to like you.
Makes perfect sense. Comedy is a defense mechanism. And she didn't hang around. Dropped out of college pretty quick and hit the stand-up circuit from 1979 to 84. Started when she was just 17.
17! Wow. And then the big break, the thing that really took her from clubs to like national awareness, that came in 84.
Star Search. That was the launch pad.
Right. She wasn't just on it. She killed it, right?
Totally. Won 5 weeks in a row. That kind of national exposure, you just couldn't buy it back then.
And that led straight into TV roles.
Yeah. Early stuff like Give Me a Break in 86, hosting VH1's stand-up spotlight a couple years later, building momentum.
And then the leap to movies. And not just small parts. A League of Their Own, 1992. That was massive.
Huge. And look who she's alongside. Tom Hanks, Gina Davis. Madonna.
Right. And she and Madonna apparently hit it off immediately, became lifelong friends. Yeah, that friendship endured. And her film career through the 90s, it's actually pretty diverse when you look back. People kind of forget that because the talk show became so huge.
True. Like, she was the sarcastic best friend in Sleepless in Seattle.
Perfect casting. Then totally different, Betty Rubble in the live action Flintstones.
Yeah. And more serious stuff too, like Beautiful Girls.
Yeah.
And voice work. Remember Turk in Disney's Tarzan?
Oh, yeah, the gorilla. She had range.
But what's maybe even more telling than the roles she took are the ones she turned down. Especially right before the talk show launched. It feels like she was carefully crafting an image.
Definitely. Two big what-ifs stand out in the sources. First, she was apparently seriously considered for Elaine Benny's on Seinfeld.
Wow. Imagine that alternate timeline. Elaine played by Rosie O'Donnell.
Totally different show. But the rejection that really speaks volumes, I think, is Hocus Pocus.
Ah, yes. Disney wanted her for Mary Sanderson, the sort of goofy witch sister. Kathy Najimy eventually got the part.
And the reason she turned it down, according to our sources, she said she explicitly refused to play a character who was a frightening, evil witch, especially one mean to kids.
So connect that back to the comedy's armor idea.
Exactly. It fits perfectly. Her whole public persona, her coping mechanism maybe, was built on being likable, funny, relatable, not scary, not evil.
She was building the character that was about to take over daytime TV.
The Queen of Nice, hashtag tag 3. The Queen of Nice and the Dawn of Activism, 1996-2002.
Right. So 1996, the Rosie O'Donnell Show launches her own production company, Kid Row Productions. And it wasn't just a success, it was huge.
A phenomenon.
Yeah.
Multiple daytime Emmys. It really changed the feel of daytime TV for a while. And that nickname stuck, Queen of Nice.
It felt like an antidote, didn't it, to maybe some of the more cynical talk shows or the trashier daytime stuff that was around then?
Totally. It was all upbeat energy, lighthearted interviews. Remember the koosh balls she'd toss to the audience?
Yeah, the koosh balls and the constant professed crush on Tom Cruise.
Right. It made her seem accessible, friendly, celebrity culture, but kind of defanged, you know, less edgy.
And she really used that New York City location to her advantage, became this massive champion for Broadway.
Oh, absolutely. Constantly had casts on, promoting shows, giving away tickets. She gave Broadway a huge boost, a real force for the arts community there, using her platform for generosity.
That generosity was central to the brand. But then things started to shift. That brand started to kind of bump up against her own developing political conscience.
The big pivot point seems to be 1999, after the Columbine High School shootings. That event really seemed to galvanize her.
And the Queen of Nice persona, well, it couldn't really contain the anger she felt about that, could it?
Not at all. She became incredibly outspoken, a leading voice advocating for gun control, got heavily involved with things like the Million Mom March.
And her statements weren't wishy-washy. For a daytime host, they were really aggressive.
Shockingly direct for that time slot. She said, flat out on her show, you are not allowed to own a gun, and if you do own a gun, I think you should go to prison.
Wow. But here's the massive contradiction, the thing people jumped on immediately.
The Kmart connection.
Exactly. While she's saying this on TV, she's also the multi-million dollar celebrity spokesperson for Kmart.
Which, at that specific time, was the single largest volume retailer of firearms in the entire U.S.
Oh, I couldn't script that irony better. The tension was just right there out in the open.
And it culminated in that incredibly awkward, now infamous, interview in 1999 with Tom Selleck.
Oh, yeah. He was on to promote a movie, The Love Letter, I think.
Yeah, but Selleck was also, you know, known for being an NRA member and doing some unpaid ads for them.
And Rosie didn't just ask him about it. She went after him. Hard.
It was an interrogation, really. Pushing him on the NRA's stance on so-called assault weapons, trying to get him to apologize for being involved with them. Live on daytime TV, Selleck looked completely blindsided.
So uncomfortable to watch. She ended it by saying something like the conversation hadn't gone how she'd hoped.
Yeah, a massive understatement. It showed just how difficult it was to use that nice platform for what was becoming a pretty nasty political fight for her.
Did the Kmart deal end soon after?
It did. Later that same year, 1999, there was huge backlash from gun rights groups, obviously. The pressure mounted and the contract ended.
But the fight had become personal, too. The sources mentioned security concerns.
Yeah, this really underscores the reality of that kind of public conflict. In 2000, because of threats against her and her family, direct results of her gun control stance, her security team actually requested that her bodyguard apply for a concealed carry permit.
So the very thing she was fighting against, private citizens carrying guns, became something her own team felt was necessary to protect her.
The irony is profound. It shows the real-world cost, the personal risk involved in taking such a public, controversial stand.
So she's already deep in political controversy. Then comes another major pivot, just as the show is ending in 2002, a deeply personal one.
Her public coming out as a lesbian.
And the way she did it was very rosy.
Strategic makeup. Seems like it. First, she played a lesbian mom on an episode of Will and Grace. Then, shortly after, during a stand-up gig, she just declared, I'm a dyke.
But the reason she gave, the main motivation, wasn't just about personal truth, was it?
No, not primarily. She framed it as explicitly political. It was a direct protest against Florida's laws at the time, which banned gay people from adopting children.
Right. She was already a foster and adoptive mom herself. So she was using her coming out, her celebrity, to shine a huge spotlight on that specific issue.
Yeah.
Affecting LGBTQ families.
Which is powerful. But inevitably, perhaps, it also caused some friction even within the LGBTQ community.
How so?
Well, some activists pointed to all those years of her joking about being infatuated with Tom Cruise on the show. They argued it felt deceptive, like she'd been playing a role for mainstream acceptance.
Ah, the authenticity question. How did she respond?
With a very characteristic, blunt comeback. She basically said about Cruise, "I said I wanted him to mow my lawn and bring me a lemonade. I never said I wanted to blow him."
Okay, yeah, that sounds like her. Using humor to deflect criticism.
Pretty much. But despite that minor controversy, she was widely recognized as a major advocate. The Advocate magazine named her Person of the Year in 2002. She started writing a column for them.
So when her talk show ended later that year, the Queen of Nice chapter was definitively closed.
Absolutely. The activist was now front and center, and the stage was set for even more fireworks. Hashtag Chactag 5e. The Turbulent View and the Age of Hyper-Controversy, 2006, 2007, 2014, 2015.
Okay, buckle up. Because the next chapter, starting around 2006, it's not just controversial. It's like controversy squared, hyper-controversy.
Yeah, this is when she joins The View. She takes over from Meredith Vieira as moderator in September 2006. And this move, it wasn't just a job change for her. It arguably helped change the whole landscape of daytime TV.
How do you mean?
Well, the network probably knew what they were getting to some extent. Rosie immediately brought this huge buzz factor, as the sources call it. The show became much more focused on news, on arguments. Exactly. And the numbers proved it worked, at least initially. Ratings shot up 27% in her first year. Record highs for the show. She basically demonstrated that conflict could sell, even in that traditionally softer daytime slot.
It kind of paved the way for the sort of partisan shout fests we see everywhere now, maybe.
You could definitely argue that. She and Joy Behar formed this strong liberal pairing, constantly taking on the Bush administration, the Iraq War.
Which inevitably put them on a collision course with the show's conservative voice at the time, Elizabeth Hasselbeck.
Constantly sparring, but Rosie's controversies often went way beyond typical political debate. She took aim at institutions.
Like the Catholic Church comments.
Yeah, that was back in 2003, even before The View, talking about the abuse scandals. She said she hoped the church got sued so much they'd have to melt down some of the gold toilets in the Pope's Vatican to pay.
Oof, yeah, that's going to generate heat. And she didn't stop there, right? On The View itself.
Nope. 2007, after a Supreme Court ruling on abortion, she jumps into this whole separation of church and state thing by asking, rhetorically, how many Supreme Court judges are Catholic?
Again, deliberately provocative, designed to get a reaction.
Absolutely. These weren't accidental slips of the tongue. They felt calculated. But sometimes the provocation backfired spectacularly, like the racial gaffe in December 2006.
Ah, the Ching Chong incident.
Yeah. Trying to imitate Chinese newscasters, she used that phrase repeatedly. The backlash was intense, especially from Asian American groups who felt, you know, betrayed by someone seen as a progressive ally.
And her apology didn't really help, did it?
Not really. It got heavily criticized. Time called it a pseudo-apology. She claimed she didn't know the phrase was that offensive, comparing ignorance levels to the N-word.
Which is already shaky ground.
Right. But then she kind of undercut the whole thing by adding this weird disclaimer, almost joking, that she'd probably do something like that again, probably in the next week, not on purpose.
Hmm. It reads as dismissive, doesn't it? Right. Like, she couldn't fully own the impact of her words. A pattern, maybe.
It does seem like a pattern. That inability to maybe filter or to fully grapple with the consequences of her rhetoric. And that tendency then led directly into the defining feud of her career. The one that really previewed our modern political climate.
The war with Donald Trump.
It kicked off in December 2006. Remember the Miss USA scandal with Tara Conner? Trump made this big show of reinstating her after some controversy.
Right.
Rosie went after him on The View, basically accusing him of exploiting the situation for publicity.
And questioned his moral standing to do so.
Oh, yeah. Pointed to his multiple marital affairs and questionable business bankruptcies. Now, this is 2006 Trump, remember? Reality TV star, tabloid guy, not yet the political figure.
But his reaction was something else.
Instantaneous, vicious, a total media assault. He threatened to sue her, never actually did, but he hurled these incredibly personal insults, called her names, attacked her appearance.
And made that really chilling comment about her partner at the time, Kelly Carpenter.
Yeah, suggesting he'd send one of my friends to pick up her girlfriend Kelly and I think it would be easy. Just deeply unpleasant, threatening stuff. Way beyond typical celebrity spats.
And this put Barbara Walters, the show's creator and sort of den mother, in a really tough spot.
Totally caught in the middle. Rosie felt Barbara didn't defend her strongly enough against Trump's attacks. Sources say there was a major blow-up between them in a dressing room over it. Loyalty, betrayal, all that raw emotion.
So the tension is just ratcheting up. And it all boils over in May 2007 during these really intense on-air debates about the Iraq War.
This is where she steps into really controversial territory regarding 9/11 truthiness.
Right. She started questioning the official account of the World Trade Center collapse, saying, "I do believe that it's the first time in history that fire has ever melted steel."
Which, you know, immediately aligns her with 9/11 conspiracy theories. And she didn't stop there with Iraq.
No, she challenged the whole narrative, asking her co-hosts, 655,000 Iraqi civilians dead, who are the terrorists?
And that line, "who are the terrorists?" was immediately seized upon by conservative media as her equating U.S. soldiers with terrorists. Whether she meant it that way or not, that's how it landed.
And that led straight to the final explosive confrontation with Elizabeth Hasselbeck.
Yeah. The core of that argument was Rosie feeling that Elizabeth, who she considered a friend, wouldn't defend her against those specific conservative attacks. She felt betrayed.
But the actual breaking point, the thing that made her walk away, wasn't just the argument itself.
No, according to the sources, it was a production choice. During that heated exchange, the show used a really dramatic split-screen visual. Rosie on one side, Elizabeth on the other. Pure visual conflict.
And Rosie saw that as?
As a setup. She felt the producers deliberately chose that visual to maximize the drama, to egg her on, as she put it, rather than facilitating any kind of real resolution. She felt used for ratings.
So she quit. Just like that.
2 days later, she was gone. Walked away from her contract early.
But in a way, it proved her point about the ratings, didn't it?
Ironically, yes. ABC News reported that those specific arguments, that period of intense conflict, gave The View its best ratings ever. Conflict sells.
She did eventually return years later.
Briefly. Fall of 2014, new panel with Whoopi Goldberg, Rosie Perez, Nicole Wallace.
But it didn't last long that time either.
No, only about 5 months. She left again in February 2015, cited health reasons, personal issues, maybe the fire wasn't there, or maybe that format just wasn't right for her anymore.
So, okay, conflict seems to be the theme, both on screen and off. When she stepped away from hosting, she poured that same intensity into other ventures, right? Business, philanthropy.
Yeah, and with pretty mixed results. You see this pattern of really ambitious projects, some marked by spectacular failures and legal fights, and others by incredible dedication and success, usually tied to her personal passions.
The Rosie Magazine venture is a prime example of the former, isn't it?
Yeah.
Launched in 2000.
Right. Partnered with the publishers of McCall's. The idea was to directly compete with Oprah's O Magazine, which was massive.
And it started well.
Strong launch, yeah. Circulation hit like 3.5 million, but the partnerships just imploded. Fast. Mm-hmm. Over what?
Control.
Specifically, editorial control. Rosie wanted final say. The publishers resisted. Classic power struggle. She quit in 2002, only 2 years in.
And then came the lawsuits.
Oh, yeah. Both sides sued each other for breach of contract. It went to trial in 2003. Very public, very messy.
And that trial produced another one of those just jaw-dropping Rosie moments.
The cancer comment. Yeah. Under cross-examination, talking to a former colleague who happened to be a breast cancer survivor.
She said, what was it exactly?
She told her essentially that people who lie get sick and they get cancer.
Oh my God. Linking lying to cancer to a survivor's face in open court.
Just an unbelievable lapse. She apologized the next day, said it came from her own trauma around her mother's death from cancer, but the damage was immense.
How did the lawsuit end?
The judge eventually threw the whole thing out, dismissed both cases, said neither side deserved damages, basically called the whole venture a wash, a failure on both sides.
Okay, so that was one big swing and a miss. What about Taboo, the musical?
Another passion project. She brought that Boy George musical to Broadway in 2003, championed it heavily, put her own money in.
But it didn't fare well commercially either.
No, mostly bad reviews. Closed pretty quickly in 2004 after only about 100 performances. A financial disappointment for her.
But here's where you see the other side of the pattern, maybe. Her reaction to Taboo's failure was different.
Totally different. Despite losing money and getting panned, Rosie called producing Taboo the most fulfilling experience of her entire career.
So the fulfillment came from the act of creation, the passion, not necessarily the commercial success or lack of conflict.
Seems like it. When her ventures failed, it was often about business disputes or market realities. When they succeeded or when she felt fulfilled, it was because they aligned with her core values and activism.
Which leads us perfectly to our family vacation.
Exactly. Co-founded in 2003, and the mission was crystal clear, deeply personal for her.
Providing the very first all-gay and lesbian family vacation packages.
Revolutionary at the time. The first cruise they did, in 2004, had 1,600 passengers, including 600 kids. It was about creating a safe, affirming space.
More than just a vacation, right? They tackled issues.
Yeah, held discussions about adoption, surrogacy, things that were still really challenging for LGBTQ families to navigate openly back then. She wasn't just talking about support. She was building the infrastructure for it, using her resources.
And her philanthropy goes way beyond that one venture. The scale is huge.
Immense. Remember her memoir, Find Me, from 2002? She took the entire $3 million advance from that book.
$3 million.
And used it to start her For All Kids Foundation, which, according to sources, has given out over $22 million in grants since then.
Wow. And she had some creative fundraising methods, too.
Huh. Yeah, the Listerine story is classic Rosie. Apparently, Scope, a Listerine competitor, ran some ad calling her unkissable or something like that.
Okay.
So instead of just getting mad, she partnered with Listerine. They agreed to donate $1,000 to her foundation every single time a guest kissed her on the Rosie O'Donnell show.
No way. That's brilliant. Turning an insult into cash for charity.
Totally. Raised over $350,000 just from that one stunt. And overall, the giving is substantial. Sources report she's donated well over $100 million in total throughout her career.
Including putting a massive chunk of money from one contract straight into a trust.
Yeah, $50 million from a five-year contract, put it into an irrevocable trust just for charitable giving. Whatever else you say about her, her financial commitment to her causes is undeniable.
Shifting gears a bit, let's talk about her health. Because the sources draw a direct line from that early trauma we discussed to her ongoing struggles, both mental and physical.
It's a through line, yeah. She's been open about dealing with major depressive disorder, PTSD, severe anxiety.
And she explicitly connects it back.
Yes. She's publicly attributed her mental health issues and also body image struggles directly to the sexual abuse she suffered from her father as a child.
That armor of comedy, like we said, it covered the wounds but didn't heal them.
Seems that way. And physically, she's had some serious scares, too. There was a bad staph infection back in 2000, almost lost her hand, apparently.
But the big one was the heart attack in 2012.
Yeah, August 2012. Found out she had a major artery, the Widowmaker, 99% blocked. Needed a stent immediately.
That sounds like a massive wake-up call.
Absolutely. It prompted a complete lifestyle overhaul. She became a big advocate for preventative heart health. Adopted a strict whole foods, plant-based diet following Dr. Esselstyn's work.
And she stuck with that.
Seems so, though she also manages type 2 diabetes. But that heart attack was a clear turning point in focusing on her physical health.
And we also see her mental health intersecting with the political climate later on. The sources mention struggles with alcohol.
Yeah, she'd given up drinking back in 2008, partly for weight loss. But she revealed that after the 2016 election, with Trump winning.
The old adversary.
Right. She said she became very depressed and started over-drinking again as a way to cope with that political reality. A stark reminder of how intertwined her personal well-being in the political world had become. #tech#cissex, personal life, children, and political expatriation.
That intertwining of the personal and political is really evident in her family life too, isn't it? Her relationships, her kids, it's all bound up with her activism.
Absolutely. She adopted her first son, Parker, way back in 1995, even before the talk show really took off. He later went to Valley Forge Military Academy, interestingly enough.
And her first marriage to Kelly Carpenter in 2004, that wasn't just a private ceremony.
No, it was a deliberate political statement. They got married in San Francisco during that brief period when Mayor Gavin Newsom was issuing licenses to same-sex couples.
Specifically as a challenge to George W. Bush.
Explicitly. Defiance against his push for a constitutional amendment banning gay marriage, using her wedding as activism.
But that marriage didn't legally stand for long, did it?
No, the California Supreme Court nullified those marriages later that same year. Rosie and Kelly separated in 2007.
Her second marriage was to Michelle Rounds.
Yes, married in 2012, they adopted a daughter, Dakota, together, but they divorced in 2015, and then, very sadly, Michelle Rounds died by suicide in 2017.
Just layers of difficulty and tragedy there. Which brings us to maybe the most difficult recent development, involving her daughter, Chelsea.
Yeah, this is tough stuff, and it really seems to highlight the ongoing impact of that generational trauma we talked about earlier.
People might remember Chelsea went missing for a time back in 2015 that made headlines. But the situation described in late 2024 sources is much more serious.
Extremely serious. Arrests in Marinette County, Wisconsin. The charges listed are harrowing. Child neglect, domestic abuse, maintaining a drug trafficking facility, meth possession, illegally getting prescriptions, THC possession.
And the reported details about the conditions where her own child, Rosie's grandchild, was found.
Just awful. The sources mention crack pipes, feces, and garbage in the house where the 11-month-old was living. It's a devastating picture. Suggests that cycle of trauma, addiction, instability. It's continuing, despite Rosie's fame and resources.
A deeply private struggle playing out in the most public way imaginable. And it's against this backdrop of personal crisis that Rosie makes her biggest political statement yet.
The move to Ireland. Expatriation.
Right. March 2025.
Yeah.
Just a couple of months after Donald Trump's second inauguration. She announces she'd actually moved to Ireland 2 months prior with her younger child, Clay.
And her reasoning was explicitly political. She cited heartbreak, despair over the U.S. political direction, said they felt they needed to take care of ourselves and make some hard decisions.
A complete physical disengagement for the American political scene she'd been so central to for decades.
And she's making it official, right? Applying for citizenship.
Yes. Through descent. Leveraging her father's roots. Remember Edward Joseph O'Donnell from County Donegal?
Ah, there it is. Full circle. Using that heritage to find a new home.
Initially rented near Dublin in Howth, but then moved.
Yeah, sources say she moved to Sandymount, another Dublin coastal suburb. The reason given was very practical, very personal. Finding a specialist school for her daughter, Dakota, who is autistic.
So seeking refuge, seeking support for her family. But even across the Atlantic, the conflict found her.
Of course it did. In July 2025, who weighs in but former President Trump?
Naturally.
Publicly threatening to try and revoke her U.S. birthright citizenship because she left and criticized him.
It's almost surreal. Even in self-imposed exile, that defining feud, that conflict she was so much a part of, continues to shape her story. #7, conclusion and provocative thought.
So when you pull back and look at the whole arc, these four decades. It really is a story of extremes, isn't it? Molded by that intense early trauma, the loss, the abuse.
Which maybe necessitated the creation of that first public persona, the Queen of Nice, that friendly, funny armor.
Yeah, but that armor got shed pretty quickly, didn't it? Swapped for the heavy artillery of the political activist, the commentator.
And she wielded that platform with real conviction on issues she cared about. LGBTQ adoption rights, gun control. Pouring huge amounts of her own money, over $100 million, into backing those causes. Her successes often came from that place of care.
Definitely. Yet, at the same time, she engaged in rhetoric that was undeniably inflammatory, often seemed ill-considered, even reckless. The comments about the Catholic Church, the cancer comment during the trial, the 9/11 Steele comments.
She didn't just participate in conflict TV, she arguably helped pioneer it on daytime. Those arguments on The View, especially with Hasselbeck, became must-see TV precisely because they were so explosive. Ratings gold.
She understood the market for partisan conflict, and she leaned into it hard. Her later career absolutely thrived on the heat, the friction, the debates she ignited. She was a central figure in defining that divisive tone in American culture.
For decades. And now. She's physically left, abandoned the arena, moved to Ireland, citing political despair, needing to protect herself and her family.
Fleeing the very climate she was instrumental in creating and amplifying.
Which brings us to our final thought. Something for you, the listener, to chew on, based on everything we've just laid out from the sources.
Yeah. Considering how much of her later career was built on generating, participating in, and frankly, benefiting from public political conflict.
Does a celebrity who spent decades defining and thriving on that kind of warfare, shaping that very climate, does she then possess the right to simply step away, move abroad, seek citizenship elsewhere, citing heartbreak over the state of the country she herself helped to shape?
Is it a valid retreat or an abdication of sorts, something to think about?